All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 653 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, I'm going to be talking about I'm going to be doing a step two, step three rapid review. This is going to be series 137. Right. Again, I will encourage you, if you missed the last one, I would really encourage you to listen to the last one. It was episode 651. It was series 136. There was a bunch of just kind of weird high yield things I emphasized that they love to test on the exams. So let's jump right into it. Right. So, and I will encourage you for this one, the things I kind of plan to discuss, I will encourage you to go back, have a computer in front of you, you know, and just look things up, like look up photos, look up images of these things as I discuss them, right? But what if they give you a question about a flat, you know, dark, smooth skin lesion in a child, right? And typically it's going to be on the palms and on the soles. Typically it's going to be on the palms and on the soles. If you see this, I'd really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this is a junctional nevus. This is a junctional nevus. This is something they love to test on the exams. This is actually the most common mole in kids, right? So look this up, right? Again, remember lesions on the palms and soles. The USMLEs, they know that everybody that has the job description, medical student has memorized, Coxsackie A with hand, foot, mouth disease. They know you've memorized Rickettsia, Rickettsii, right? Rocky Mountain spotted fever, right? And they know you know about secondary syphilis, right? But don't forget, you can have lesions on the palms and soles in a person that has a Kawasaki's disease as well, right? But a junctional nevus can also be found on the palms and soles, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a farmer or a gardener, right? So a person that works outdoors, right? Although they know that most people have caught on with farmers or gardeners. So these days, they can give this exact same thing to like a lifeguard, right? To a lifeguard or a person that works outdoors a lot for whatever reason, right? So it can be a person that is in the military, in the desert or something like that, right? So you know how they love military questions. So they can give you a question about a person that is deployed, you know, has been deployed for the last couple of months in the desert or in North Africa or in the Middle East or something like that. And then they tell you that this person has this small, you know, has these small, rough, you know, erythematous, you know, papules on the back, right? That have like a sandpaper texture, or they say they have a rough texture. When you see something like this, I'd really hope you're thinking of actinic keratosis. I'd really hope you're thinking of what? Actinic keratosis. Remember, they can ask you what is the most likely outcome of this person's skin lesion. You want to put a resolution, right? Resolution is the most likely outcome. Most people that have actinic keratosis, it becomes a nothing burger. It completely resolves. But remember, actinic keratosis, one of the reasons we treat it is that it can proceed to squamous cell carcinoma of the skin. Squamous cell carcinoma of the skin. Right. And again, how do we treat it? We're going to treat it with topical 5-fluorouracil, topical 5-FU. Right. Sometimes on your exams, instead of using the term topical 5-FU, because again, they know that that is in every onky deck known to mankind, the thing they'd rather do is they'll put like topical chemotherapy. Right. Topical chemotherapy. I'm telling you this, and this is a sermon I've been preaching now for the last couple of classes that I've been teaching with my test taking class and actually many of my other review courses. The USMLEs, they are almost on an anti-onky crusade. Anti-onky crusade. It's almost like literally the words and expressions. Don't get me wrong, right? A lot of what you're studied, you're still going to see it on your exams. But every year, things are getting, they're getting better and better at taking the words that you're familiar with and putting different words or putting things that are intentionally vague. It still mirrors and reflects the same thing you've learned, but just put differently, just to see if they can force you to think or if you can get tripped up easily, right? Now, remember, for actinic keratosis, they can ask you a risk factor question, right? The biggest risk factor is going to be sun exposure. And again, don't forget the demographic I just voiced, right? Gardeners, landscapers, farmers, people that work outside, right? Okay. Now, what if they give you a question about a 75-year-old male and they tell you that, oh, he has a history of a Parkinson's disease, right? And that for the last 3 months, he has noticed this discolored, you know, skin lesion, right? And then they show you an image and you see this like this plaque that kind of looks like somebody like glued it to the person's skin, right? If you see this, I'd really hope you're thinking of what? Of seborrheic keratosis. Remember, it can also be found in Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's disease has a very strong association with two seborrheic problems, right? It can be associated with seborrheic dermatitis, right? Because remember, Parkinson's affects the autonomic nervous system, right? So, you can secrete more sebum, and that can create like a really good environment for bugs that can cause seborrheic dermatitis. But Parkinson's is also associated with seborrheic keratosis, right? Typically, it's going to have this stuck-on appearance, going to have this stuck-on appearance, right? It's going to have this stuck-on appearance. Now, what if they give you a question right, on your exams. This question that I'm about to voice, most people get it wrong, but you will not get it wrong because you are paying attention to this podcast. So what if they give you a question on your exams and they tell you that, you know, this person is an adult, right? And this person, you know, has this, you know, and they may even show you an image, right? You see this large pigmented lesion, right? It has irregular borders, right? And it's actually in an area that is sun protected. Right? If you see something like that, and then you're looking at your answers and you're like, wait, I'm looking for melanoma. I can't see melanoma as an answer. You're kind of scratching your head. If you see something like this, I will strongly encourage you to pick the answer that talks about a dysplastic nevus. I strongly encourage you to pick an answer that talks about what? Dysplastic nevus, right? So how is it going to be tested on your exams? It's going to be a large lesion. It's going to be pigmented, right? And it's going to have irregular borders. And typically, it will be on a sun-protected area. If you see this, think of a dysplastic nevus. Right? Now, the thing is, again, typically, it's going to be a chronic problem. They're going to have had it for a long time, right? And you'll notice that it's not something that is necessarily changing recently, right? Like, you know, like melanomas, right? Change, right? You probably, hopefully, know your ABCDEs of melanoma. I'm going to talk about that after this, right? But you notice that it's like a chronic unchanging lesion. And classically, they will not put melanoma as an answer choice. When you see something like this, think of a dysplastic nevus, right? And I was saying, hey, what's the ABCDE of melanoma? Well, remember the A stands for asymmetry, right? The B stands for border irregularity. The C stands for color. It's going to have multiple colors. The D stands for diameter. It's going to be greater than 6 millimeters in diameters, right? And it's going to, the E is evolving, right? It's going to have that quality of change. It's going to be changing. It's going to be changing, right? That's pretty high yield to know for your exams. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they, or even just make it like an epidemiology question, right? Like, what's the most common skin malignancy? Well, remember, the most common skin malignancy obviously is going to be basal cell carcinoma of the skin, right? And typically, it's going to be above the upper lip, right? But again, our friends at the MBMEs, they know that many people have learned some of these general rules, right? Many people have learned some of these what? General rules, right? So remember, it does not always have to be above the upper lip. It can literally be below the lower lip. So just be careful. But classically, it's going to be above the upper lip is the most common skin malignancy, right? And it tends to have telangiectasias. That's a very critical thing to know. It tends to have these blood vessels, these tiny blood vessels kind of overlying it, right? So those telangiectasias, that's very characteristic of basal cell carcinoma, right? Classically, squamous cell carcinoma, on the other hand, tends to be below the lip, right? It tends to be ulcerated and you'll have no telangiectasias, right? Tends to be what? Below the lip, not ulcerated, below the lip is ulcerated and has no telangiectasias. Below the lip is ulcerated, no telangiectasias. Think of squamous cell carcinoma of the skin. Right? And what is the biggest risk factor for skin cancer? Just in general, what is the biggest risk factor for skin cancer? Well, the biggest risk factor is going to be UV exposure, right? And sometimes on the exams, they'll give you different kinds of UV light and you have to pick the correct one. Pick the one that says UVB, right? Ultraviolet B. UVB exposure is the biggest risk factor for skin cancer on the USMLE exams, right? And typically, the people that get skin cancers on the USMLEs are going to be Caucasians, right? It's going to be Caucasians. They're going to have blue eyes, right? That's going to be like the classic patients, the classic demographic that they throw in on the exams for skin cancer, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, right? And they tell you that, oh, this is a 10-year-old child, and this child just has like severe photosensitivity, like blisters and whatnot when they're exposed to the sun, right? And, you know, they tell you that, oh, that, you know, whenever they have sun exposure, it's just terrible, 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 terrible for them. When you see something like this, think of xeroderma pigmentosum, right? Xeroderma pigmentosum, right? It's an autosomal recessive disease, right? And these people have defective DNA damage repair. What kind of DNA damage repair do they struggle with? Well, it's the repair of thymidine dimers. It's the repair of what? Of thymidine dimers, right? Don't mix this up with ataxia telangiectasia. Ataxia telangiectasia, they have an ATM mutation. And those people that have ataxia telangiectasia, the thing they struggle with is double-stranded DNA repair, right? So those people struggle with x-rays. It's x-rays they struggle with, right? So please, let me really make sure that I throw this out there. People that have xeroderma pigmentosum, they struggle with UV rays. People that have ataxia telangiectasia struggle with x-rays, right? So UV rays are not going to be a problem for a person with ataxia telangiectasia, okay? Keep that in mind, right? People that have xeroderma pigmentosum, they struggle with UV rays. UV rays lead to the creation of thymidine dimers. Those people struggle with those things, okay? They struggle with those things, okay? So please, I'm telling you this. This is something that in the heat of an exam, a person can mess this up. Don't mess this up because you're paying attention. I'm going to repeat it again. Xeroderma pigmentosum, right? It is UV rays that bug them. Ataxia telangiectasia, right, is going to be x-rays that bother them. X-rays create double-stranded DNA breaks, okay? X-rays do not create thymidine dimers. It's UV rays that do. Okay, so again, I've really hit this. I really, really hope that you don't get this wrong on a test, right? If you get this wrong on a test, you should feel really bad because I basically repeated this thing like three times, like literally three times, right? Both of those diseases, they have the same mode of inheritance. It's autosomal recessive, right? But you got to know those things for your exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and this patient has had a burn wound for like the last 10 years? It has not healed. And then they ask you like, what's the most likely diagnosis? I'd hope you're picking an answer that says a squamous cell cancer, right? Squamous cell cancer. That person has a Marjolin's ulcer. M-A-R-J-O-L-I-N, a Marjolin's ulcer. They are less likely to put the term Marjolin's ulcer on your exams and more likely to put squamous cell carcinoma on your exams, right? Because again, Marjolin seems like something that will make its way to an Anki deck, right? So again, they're not going to do that. They're going to use the term squamous cell cancer, right? So if you see a person that has a skin wound that just doesn't seem to be getting better, think of a Marjolin's ulcer, which is again a form of a squamous cell carcinoma, right? And then if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, wants to move to an area, like an area of the country that has a lot of sun exposure, right? That has a lot of, you know, water, you know, where they can go by the beach. And then they ask you, which of the following interventions would most strongly reduce the person's risk of skin cancer, right? You know, what are some things you can do to reduce your risk of skin cancer? Well, number one, don't forget like sunscreen, right? Sunscreen that has an SPF, a sun protective factor that is 15 plus, right? That is at least 15 plus, right? And then you also want to wear protective clothing, right? Now, there is one strange thing amazing friends at the MBMEs love to do to people on the exams, right? So if they give you between sunscreen as an answer and they give you protective clothing as an answer, they are literally both answers to the same question. Which one should you pick to reduce your risk of skin cancer? Which one should you pick to reduce your risk of skin cancer? I would really hope you're saying, oh, divine, protective clothing. Protective clothing is what you should pick. I know, you're like, oh, divine, everywhere I've seen sunscreen. Pick sunscreen on your exams and see what happens. Just try that and see what happens. All right, let's keep going. Now, what is the most important prognostic factor you may see on your test in the setting of a person that has melanoma? What is the most important prognostic factor? Well, I'd hope you're saying that, divine, oh, I should be thinking about the thickness, right? The Breslow, B-R-E-S-L-O-W, B-R-E-S-L-O-W, the Breslow depth or the Breslow thickness, right? So that is the most important prognostic factor, the deeper, the thicker, right? The more likely you're going to get in a big amount of trouble, right? You're going to have a worse prognosis that way, right? Now, let's do some matching games, right? Let's do some matching games. I think derm is pretty good for this, right? So let's do some matching games with like some skin cancers, right? So which one is locally destructive with very little risk of metastasis? Locally destructive, very little risk of metastasis. Very good. It's going to be basal cell carcinoma of the skin. Okay. Now, what is the one that can present on your exams as a small bowel obstruction? That's going to be melanoma. Very good. And then which one can arise from Marjolin's ulcers or actinic keratosis? Okay. It's going to cell cancer. Very good. Right. Which one can arise after a person has gotten a transplanted organ, right, and they've been on immunosuppression? Very good. Squamous cell cancer, right? Again, don't forget melanomas. I don't know, for whatever reason, almost no resource covers this specific factoid, but it's actually very, very high yield to know for your exams. Our friends at the MBMEs can give you a question about a person that has a skin lesion, right? And it a melanoma, and it literally metastasizes to the bowel and causes a small bowel obstruction, right? Whenever you see a person that has like a history of like intense sun exposure and they show you like a skin lesion and the person has been constipated for a really long period of time, think of metastatic melanoma. It has literally metastasized to the person's small bowel, right? Obviously, when you have that kind of metastasis, like that's an awful, awful, awful prognosis, right? Let's do another matching game. But let's do it with melanomas, right? Let's use this matching game. I kind of like these matching games. Let's use these matching games to kind of hit some of these melanomas, right? So first things first, what is the most common kind of melanoma? It's going to be superficial spreading. Okay. Now, which melanoma has the best prognosis? It's going to be Lentigo Maligna. Lentigo Maligna. Lentigo. L-E-N-T-I-G-O. Maligna is a separate word. M-A-L-I-G-N-A. Right? Don't let that maligna word make you feel like, oh, this is bad. No, it actually has the best prognosis of all the melanomas. Okay. Now, of all the melanomas, for which one is UV exposure not a risk factor? For which one is UV exposure not a risk factor? UV exposure is not a risk factor. I hope you're picking the one that talks about acral lentiginous. Okay, next one. Which one is pretty common in people of color, right? And you may even find it on the sole of the foot, I hope you're also saying acral lentiginous. Okay, now, which one has the worst prognosis and is the second most common? Remember, I said the most common is superficial spreading. Which one has the worst prognosis and is actually the second most common? It's going to be nodular. All right. Now, which one has a long horizontal growth phase? It's going to be superficial spreading. Which one has a rapid initial vertical growth phase? It's going to be nodular. All right. So let's talk about these growth phases, right? I'm telling you this. Some of these rapid reviews that I put out, right, is just like, oh, it's some rapid review. It's like one out of the other 137 Divine has made. I'm telling you these rapid review series, they're not things to ignore. These things are like super, super, super high yield things that can net you a lot of really amazing points on your exams, right? And the thing is, if you're a person that is like shooting for like, hey, I want to get like in the 270s, right? It can just be questions like these where it's like, there's no test taking strategy that can save you. You've not seen it in any resource. You just randomly remember Divine spending like 2 minutes talking about like some random factoid and that's why you got it right. Right? So again, that's the thing, right? Like every question counts, right? But let's talk about these things, right? So the thing is melanomas, right? They have this phenomenon of growth phases, right? You can have a horizontal growth phase or you can have a vertical growth phase, right? Now, let me ask you this. Which growth phase do you think is really bad? Well, it's actually going to be the vertical, right? A vertical growth phase means that, oh, that thing is going deeper and is beginning to metastasize, right? But if it has a horizontal growth phase, it means that the thing is just going horizontally. It's not going deeper. Because remember, your tissue layers, right? You have like your mucosa, your submucosa and whatnot, right? As you begin to go deeper, you begin to get to the blood vessel layer of your skin. And once you get to that blood vessel layer, right, things, cancer cells can enter the bloodstream and begin to metastasize. They can begin to get to lymphatics and begin to metastasize, right? So if a person has skin cancer, you want one that has a very, very long horizontal growth phase, right? It means that, oh, it may be locally destructive, but it's not going to cause many problems because it's not going down vertical. Remember, I said that's the biggest determinant of prognosis in a person that has melanoma is the Breslow depth. Right? So the thing is, superficial spreading melanoma has a very, very long horizontal growth phase. So it doesn't metastasize very easily, right? That's why it has a pretty decent prognosis. Although remember, the prognosis is not as good as lentigo maligna, right? But what did I say was the second most common skin cancer, second most common melanoma and had the worst prognosis of all? I said nodular, right? Nodular has a very rapid initial vertical growth phase. So again, keep these things at the back of your mind, right? This can be a very easy way for them to test metastatic potential on your exams. Very easy way for them to test prognosis on your exams. That's why I'm emphasizing this. The USMLEs these days, they really, really love prognosis. Prognosis. They love these things on the exams, right? So please make sure you bank these things in your brain. All right. Just some other, I guess, maybe like random things I just want to throw in here, since we're kind of talking about derm, right? Melanomas, right? Just quick general management, right? Again, they don't go very deep on management here, right? But if it's a small lesion on your exams, you can just do some kind of excisional biopsy, right? If it's a cosmetic, if, you know, you're kind of worried about like cosmetic issues with resecting the lesion, or it's a large lesion, I'd pick the answer that talks about an incisional biopsy, right? So for small lesions, excisional. For large lesions or lesions where like it's going to be in an area of cosmetic consequence, you want to do an incisional biopsy, right? I would encourage you to almost never pick punch biopsy for melanomas. Punch biopsy, melanoma questions, not a good mix, right? And one answer you should definitely not pick with melanomas is a shave biopsy. A shave biopsy, picking a shave biopsy as your answer for melanoma is like consulting the ethics committee for an ethics question. That's not going to end well for you on your exams, right? Now, one other thing that you may also see, right? Because again, they know that many people have memorized like the Breslow depth for prognosis in melanoma. One other thing that's also pretty high yield to measure actually in the workup of melanomas is the LDH, the lactate dehydrogenase, It's actually a prognostic indicator, right? In fact, that may actually be an indicator of liver metastasis. And the reasoning behind that is well beyond the scope of the USML exam, so I'm not going to talk about it. But don't forget that measuring the LDH, the lactate dehydrogenase, is also a very good prognostic indicator, and it may be an indicator of a potential liver metastasis in a person that has a melanoma, right? And then, again, remember, we've talked about how many of the skin cancers, like the basal cell carcinoma, the squamous cell cancer, right? You can treat them with topical chemotherapy, right? You can do like topical 5-FU, right? 5-fluorouracil, right? You can use imiquimod, imiquimod, right? Imiquimod, right? Some skin cancers like basal cell, squamous cell, you can do a electrodesiccation and curettage, right? These are all words you may see on your exams. But remember, for melanoma, you pretty much always do surgery. You pretty much always do surgery. All right. And I will encourage you, for melanoma, it's usually not a smart idea to pick Mohs surgery, M-O-H-S, right? It's usually not a good idea to pick Mohs surgery for melanoma on your exams. I don't know, for whatever reason, our friends at the MBMEs, they don't like that being the correct answer for melanoma, right? And then sometimes, right, although this pops up not very frequently, but every few years, you're going to see this pop up, right? But remember, for basal cell carcinoma, what are the surgical margins you want, right? You want like 3 to 5 millimeter margins, right? And for squamous cell carcinoma, what kind of margins do you want? You want like 5 to 10 millimeter margins, 5 to 10 millimeter surgical margins. And you may be like, oh, Divine, how do I remember which is which? Well, just remember that the larger number, the larger margin goes with a bigger letter, right? All right. And then, you know, don't forget, right? Another skin thing, right? Don't forget your neck fascia, right? Remember, you know, diabetic, who are the classic people that get necrotizing fasciitis, right? Diabetics, IV drug users, right? You may see bulla, you may see crepitus, you may see hyponatremia, right? The lesions tend to be violaceous. You may see gas bubbles on imaging, right? When you see this, think of neck fascia. And remember, neck fascia tends to be a polymicrobial infection, right? Don't forget your SGLT2 inhibitors that can cause a neck fascia of the perineum, right? Which we call Fournier's gangrene, right? And again, remember, if your culture, a strep bovis or Clostridium septicum, right, you need to go ahead and do a colonoscopy, right, to screen those people for colorectal cancer, right? A lot of colorectal cancer. And sometimes when a person has neck fascia, right, if there's a lot of muscle involvement, if there's a lot of muscle death, you actually need to consider amputation in those people. But again, remember, how do you handle neck fascia? Right? Debridement, and antibiotics, broad spectrum antibiotics. Okay. And now there's this kind of strange thing our friends at the MBMEs love to do with cellulitis, right? Because many of you can probably recognize cellulitis pretty easily. But I've noticed one strange thing that they love to do these days is they can ask you what layer of the skin is involved. You're like, wait, what? What layer of the skin is involved? If you notice, for cellulitis, don't forget that it's the deep dermis and subcutaneous tissue that is involved in cellulitis, okay? It's the deep dermis and subcutaneous tissue that is involved. The deep dermis and subcutaneous tissue, all right? And then the last thing I'm just going to talk about, this is a rapid review series. I don't want this to go too long, right? But what if you see a black scar in a postal worker? What are you thinking about? Or a postal worker with hemoptysis? Why do you need a sternum? It's going to be anthrax, right? All right. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, I'm telling you this. This is going to score you so many easy points on your exams, right? Things that people will get wrong. You don't have to get them wrong if you paid attention here. Now, do you love the way I teach? Then you're going to love my classes. I have a battery of classes kind of starting today, actually, right? So I have a 25-hour basic science review. It's for people taking step one or people taking step two, step three that have poor foundations, right? This class will benefit you tremendously. It's a case-based review, right? It's not like a review where it's just like, oh, what's the definition of this? No, right? I use cases, I use clinical scenarios to buttress the points, right? So you're learning it in the context of an MBME exam. And then after this week, the 25-hour basic science review, starting next week, I have a CCS cases class for step three specifically, right? And then after that, I have test taking strategies class for step 1, 2, 3. It's a 2.5 hour class. I have a biostats class for step 1, 2, 3. It's a 4 hour class. I have a social sciences, quality improvement, hospital medicine, ethics review. It's a 5 hour class for step 1 to step 3. Super comprehensive class. It's actually one of my most popular classes. Many people take it and find it to be extremely helpful for their exams, right? And then after that, I have the last minute review specifically for step 2 and step 3. It's a 3 hour class that shows you not just concepts that are commonly testable on the exams, but also just methods and approaches that the USMLEs use to test concepts. And then after that, I have a 20-hour step 2, step 3 review that is, again, specifically for step 2 and step 3. And then in the month of June, first weeks in the month of June, this is the only time this is going to take place this year, I have the 50-hour step 2, step 3 review, right? It's an epic, amazingly wonderful class. Many people that have taken that class have just found it to be extremely helpful. And then I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and CommonLex exams and medical school exams. And then I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify. So check those out. I also have a YouTube channel that I post all the videos that I make, right? And some podcasts that I make as well. I throw those on there. And then many of you listening to this podcast know I'm a Christ follower, right? So I do have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I post like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective, I do address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. And then I also help with ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements, recommendation letters, and things of that nature. I help with editing those things, right? Editing those things and making them very polished to what admissions committees and residency selection committees are looking for. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, in episode 654. But have a wonderful day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.